Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
It's true. That's a true fact. You can't deny it. I mean, you could deny it, but you'd have to prove it in a court of law. I have DNA evidence.
Justin Robert Young.
Well, yeah, you know, when I was first starting, you know, I said to Marty, I'm like, you know, I just want to make a movie, you know.
Man, that used to do this skit, and we'd be driving in a car to entertain ourselves, and we would be talking about Star Wars, and we'd be like, hey George, we're not going to be able to put this weird stop motion thing into the scene of Han Solo, and George Lucas would be like, you're ruining my movie.
What do you mean he can't be a frog? This movie's ruined.
We would take like all the things that we heard that he wanted to do and that he couldn't do, and then would be like, yeah, it's ruined.
Didn't he think that the cantina scene ruined the movie because, like, I guess the menagerie of aliens wasn't to his liking?
Well, he went back and shot more scenes. They added more aliens in that.
Ah.
Yeah. So that was sort of our funny thing, was just the idea that this creator who created this great thing kind of didn't know all the ways, the reasons that it be, which choices made it good and which ones did not. And that was just our funny thing, is Justin, you're ruining my movie.
There's also the fact that at Star Wars Celebration last year, I was on the phone. And this was one of my top 9 liked photos on Instagram. I was a George Lucas, old George Lucas, current George Lucas cosplayer, came up to take a picture with me while I was on the phone, thinking I was a young George Lucas. When really I was just wearing a flannel shirt and, you know, trying to mind my business.
All right. So, speaking of George, St. George.
Who we love and we absolutely owe an entire wonderful, joyful childhood to.
Exactly. So this is my point. I have said, now that Force Awakens is good, everybody loves it. It's the highest grossing movie of all time. Everything is right in the Star Wars universe. Even now, whatever criticism of the movie has been dwarfed by people's theories about who is what and when things are going to happen and what is going to be brought back, what elements of the extended universe might be roped in. There's a million different things. It is where we want to be as Star Wars fans. I have been adamant that this is when the healing would take place with the fans' relationship with George Lucas, that now that we are reset, he did the brave thing to release Star Wars when it had outgrown him. That takes bravery. And then,
I mean, it seems like
the Rose interview happened. Now I'm out. You deserve all of this, George.
I was about to say, it's like, it seems like the only way to screw things up is to inject yourself and criticize the one thing everybody universally loves.
For those of you that don't know. George Lucas talked to Charlie Rose about selling Star Wars, and he made the observation that it's his kids, that he gave his kids, and it's like selling your kids off to white slavers. He immediately apologized for that via a Disney press release.
Well, what's funny also is like, it's almost like the offensive part isn't the obvious misuse of the phrase white slavers. Like, that's the least offensive part to me in this whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, and it's not that this is an excuse for other times when people do weird behavior like that, you know, Ted Danson walking on stage dressed in inappropriately.
Blackface. Yeah.
Lucas is like, he's married to a black gal, so he's obviously not, you know, some guy sitting in some white supremacist sort of point of view, and he was trying to articulate the phrase in such a way, but I think he has very, very, very open, broad-minded views on these things, and that was not intended to be. And he immediately apologized when that was pointed out to the perception of that. And so that's not what the controversy is really about. You know, it's no. about him dissing what happened to Star Wars.
So the two big things that he says about Episode 7 is that did you guys watch the full interview?
No. Yeah, no. You got to take me through all the highlights.
Okay. Well, I mean, he seems a bit defensive or salty about how Disney did not want his treatments. You know, he makes the point that, hey, you know, every director is their own little megalomaniac and needs everything very specifically. And so when I realized that I was not going to be part of this, I just decided that I needed to step back. And here's the key. He says what we got with The Force Awakens is a retro movie. It is something for the fans, which, George uses with all of the, all of the warmth of somebody of George Wallace using, coded words about, bringing America back to where it used to be. He says that it is, not what he would have done. He would have worked very, very hard to bring in new planets and new aliens and not have everything be too much of an echo of what had happened. That, I think, his description of the movie, I think, is kind of echoes in a way that has landed the way that it did with everybody, because he's got this, like, he's so defensive. He spends half the movie, half the interview with Charlie Rose talking about how he's gonna make movies that you can't see. Like, coming back to it. Like, I'm just gonna make, I'm gonna make some films, and I'm just gonna show them to my friends, and
Charlie was like Magic and Red Tails.
Yeah, well, I mean, so he's very bitter. I mean, like, this is something that's very well known. You know, that he is bitter about the system. He's got very specific and highly political views of what gets out, and why it gets out. He is very bitter about Red Tails. He is very but he just keeps coming back to this idea of like, I just want to show it to my friends. I want to show it to other directors so other directors can see what I'm doing, and that, that affects them. And that's what directors do. You show these movies to each other. Charlie was like, so I won't get to see him? He's like, well, I mean, maybe you, I'll call you. Oh, nobody else.
Northern California billionaire socialist filmmaker.
I mean, is there – let me ask you guys this, because this is something that the more I think about it, the more I think it's totally correct, that it takes such bravery to let Star Wars go for him.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, and he had the double whammy where it's like all of a sudden I deeply regretted all the criticisms I'd lobbed over the last decade or two when he says, I'm going to give Star Wars to more talented people than me, and I'm going to take all that money and give it to charity. It's like that double whammy of setting Star Wars free and doing good. How great is that?
I think that's great. And I think that but he kind of, whenever we have a new president, the classy thing for the last president to do is to kind of wait a year or wait a little while before saying, hey, you know what? And when you hand the keys to somebody, this movie is still in theaters. It's still in theaters, and he's talking about his frustration with it.
And by the way, it made me realize, I can't. We'd have to give a minor spoiler disclaimer, but it's like after having seen the movie and seeing JJ, you remember JJ Abrams did that thing where he took questions from random celebrities and people he knew. If you remember George Lucas's question, it seems rather pointed and maybe not nice given what you learn in the movie. And that's a lot to ask people to reconstruct from memory. You could put the pieces together yourself. But when I first watched it, I was like, oh, that's cute. George Lucas is just asking you about a random silly topic. And instead, and if you look at JJ's reaction, he's just like, oh, what is this? Yeah, instead it's a giant freaking spoiler he's asking about. And it's like, well, what is that, man?
Yeah. I'm going to throw a theory out here, and I'm not going to, again, and I caveat, I so much joy in my childhood was because of his imagination, what he created. I think that part of what, if you read, again, we highly recommend the textbook for the Weird Things show, or for After Things, should be How Star Wars Conquered the Universe by Chris Taylor.
Absolutely.
And then if you kind of like get into some of the things that happened sort of after that, the cycle of that book, Lucas would have this sort of thing where he'd have periods where Star Wars merchandising was very big and he'd make a lot of money. And then he would kind of spend that money and do different projects and stuff. And then he would come back and sort of do something new, like he did the prequels, et cetera. Leading up to the prequels, he did the re-releases. And the re-releases were very successful. He re-released all the movies, did the updated. That's why he made the specialized them. So that was an excuse for them to come back to theaters. And that helped finance the prequels. That was part of the deal because he likes to self-finance. Ever since Empire, he's paid for the stuff out of pocket, so he's not beholden to a studio, and he can do whatever he wanted. So there was about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the plan was that there was the talk of he wanted to do the Star Wars TV show, Star Wars Underworld, whatever, but he couldn't get a network because no network would commit to buying 100 episodes outright. Which,
wow.
Shocker. You're kidding. He had Ronald D. Moore. He had some great, great TV writers, great people working with him on this. They wrote all the scripts for this, but that was sort of just put on hold because it just, he couldn't get anybody to go in and go buy that, which even in this age of Netflix and the success of HBO and Amazon, I don't see them saying, yeah, we'll buy 100 sight unseen, considering there needs to be a feedback mechanism or whatever. So anyhow, the plan was is that he was going to do a re-release of all six films in 3D. Do you remember this?
Oh, we only got the Phantom Menace, didn't we?
We only got the Phantom Menace, and I think it made maybe $38 million total, which if you figure out what the cost was to actually do the transfer, the cost of all the prints and everything, all the stuff that they cost in there, I think it lost money. Yeah. I think that it absolutely didn't. He released Phantom Menace. It didn't do well.
Part of the problem is that it's the Phantom Menace, right? Like, if he had just started with them in chronological order. Release order, yeah.
But, Brian, we see that problem from Lucas's point of view. Lucas doubles down on, oh, kids who grew up during Phantom Menace.
A lot of kids, Phantom Menace is their movie. And you know, I have kids all the time come up and tell me that they love the Phantom
Menace. Kids watch Clone Wars. That's their favorite. And so he believes that, and that's his mentality. So starts a Phantom Menace, and if you look at their trajectory, what would happen at those releases, you know that each one's going to make less than the next one, right? Mm-hmm. That enthusiasm. And that's what happened to special editions, is that there was, like, I think Empire may have done a little bit better than the others or something. I'm not sure, but by the time you got to Jedi,
Empire was the least agonizing of the special editions.
Oh, yeah. But by the time you got to Jedi, did the least of all three. And in a really great series, you can build up. Like, the later Harry Potter films just did monster because just that built-up anticipation. But anyhow, that came out, and that was a thing that he thought was going to be a big moneymaker, and it was not. It was not, and so all the five other films, that entire thing got canceled, and then within like a year, we're hearing, hey, Disney's making a deal. And for him, it's like, well, you know, people probably don't like Star Wars anymore. I mean, I think that was his perception, because, you know, Clone Wars was doing good, but it wasn't doing fantastic on Cartoon Network. It was a show that it was more offset by the merchandising than it was by what they were getting paid per episode. And he put a lot of money and effort into the Clone Wars cartoon. You look at what Rebels, I really think is a better written show, but it doesn't have anywhere near as many characters or backgrounds or exotic scenes going on because it's a much smaller show.
But I will give a huge thumbs up to Rebels. In fact, that's my pick as of right now. It's amazing.
Brian, I love Rebels too, when you watch an episode, you realize, oh yeah, there are probably far fewer animators working on this than Clone Wars, but where it counts, it matters. Yeah. So my theory is that basically based upon the failure of the 3D re-releases, that Lucas decided that that's one of the motivating factors for him was financials, why it was time to unload.
Do you think he'll ever be able to get out of his own way long enough for us, for the fan mass, the Star Wars fan mass, to redeem him and think
to embrace him.
There's not a collection of fans in the world that he could not walk in front of and he would not get a standing ovation.
Agreed. Fair point. Yeah.
We will cheer him, and that was the thing that we watched the Star Wars Celebration event was kind of like, I kind of wish that they did at that event, hey, this is all because of George. But yeah. I know internally the mandate was, in all the promos and all the stuff, minimize the prequels. Do not emphasize that because marketing tells them that would be bad. And that was just not where they wanted to go forward. And you look at how hard they worked to do that. You know, they're told, people I know who work with Disney said, yeah, we're told to pretty much pretend they don't exist.
Well, and here's the funny part is I can see, and I love the fact that you pointed out that Rogue One is going to be the first awesome prequel, right? I can see those side stories just stepping back and back and back farther until before we know it, all of a sudden, you know, we see the likes of Yoda again and we're back in the prequel universe. But at this point, we just have so many movies that they make us fall in love with the prequel world in a way that we didn't the first time around.
Yeah, but it's after watching Force Awakens, and like many people, I went home and I'm like, I watched a little Star Wars. I watched a little Empire, you know, first 20 minutes of Empire, whatever, just amazing. And that was a great choice by Lucas. Like, I decided to put the battle scene up front. I'm like, yeah, that worked great. And it ends in characters. So, and then I'm like, man, you know, I kind of got a hankering for more Star Wars. What do I want to do? I'm like, Do I go watch the prequels? Do I maybe just watch a little prequels? Do I watch a little prequels? I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to watch Spaceballs instead. Which I did, and I loved.
I mean, you're right. Like, I think that there will always be an element of fan, you know, the fan contingency that will always have a very complicated relationship. But he is... You know, yeah, you're right. Anywhere he walks into any room and he's going to get a big round of applause for him.
I mean, it's a little bit like all those crap-talking magicians who are rolling their eyes at David Blaine, but the second he walks into his room, they're all diving to have their picture taken with him. You know, it's like...
Yeah, but I mean, even more so that it's hard because we don't have an example. And we sometimes can think of musicians or artists that later on, if you have some emotional connection, you feel like, oh, they betrayed me or something. But with him, it's sort of like, yeah, we think he had it. His finger was on the pulse then, and then he just didn't get it. And that's sort of the common sort of thing is like, yeah. And among fans, we kind of like, man, there are a lot of really capable people working on the originals, and that's why they were so good. And so it just George doesn't understand, to me, you know, my impression.
Do you think he will be able to not step on his own wiener?
No.
Again?
No.
Nope.
I have zero confidence. He is the Jar Jar of his own career. He's constantly stepping in the poodoo.
Yeah. Yeah. Misa, sorry. So can I pitch you guys an idea for a TV show?
Yeah, sure. Hit us up.
Yeah, yeah.
We go back thousands of years in the Old Republic era, or before the Old Republic.
Back to Knights of the Old Republic, that era, sure.
Sort of like that, yeah. You know, the Force is very this raw sort of thing. They're still figuring it out. Sith, and we can take from the books what we want or whatever we do or we don't want. But basically, and it's just where people are just starting to go expand into the galaxy. And you already got like in one version of the Star Wars canon, like the dudes with the weird greenish heads and the glowing eyes and the cantina were like the first ones to sort of conquer a big part of the Star Wars galaxy. And you kind of have that, like there's an other race there that's sort of been there, and humans are starting to make it out there, but maybe they've got a few planets, a few whatever that they're conquering or whatever they're living on. Game of Thrones style Star Wars.
All of it.
I love it in there's the situation in which I love it is in a, you know, absent of the rest of the world, as it exists today, the situation in which I don't, but I keep tripping over the fact that I'm trying to fit it in with the current way they're doing things. And that's obviously, I can't see that compatibility working for what they're doing right now. I don't know. Like 5 years from now, yes, but not today. It's hard for me to see it.
Well, I mean, Kathleen Kennedy has said that they're actively looking into television, and one of the reasons that they look into that is that they look at Star Wars can be another Marvel type property, and Marvel functions with You have Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which people who watch that show love that show. You have Daredevil, which we love. We have Jessica Jones, which a lot of people who made it all the way through really, really love. And you're doing interesting things in different spaces. And then there's cartoons for kids and stuff. And for television, and particularly if they wanted to do broadcast, is it's a – if you're trying to figure out how to capitalize on young viewers, male and female viewers between 18 and 35 and still get them on broadcast. Look what CBS is doing in Star Trek. They're actually trying to sell – a net product, but again, it's because they have advertisers they want to be able to target and go after. Internally, we know that with Disney, ESPN numbers have been fleeing subscriptions, but they've been picking up online subscriptions for ESPN. And so it may be an exaggerated thing. People I've talked to internally say, no, it's not as quite as bad as it seems. We've got a lot of people internally are now subscribing to the net versions of that. It becomes an extremely attractive package if ABC wants to say, hey, subscribe to ABC or some package like that, a Star Wars TV show.
Okay, so on that regard, I love the fact that Bryce has pulled up this one of the hottest video game, most anticipated properties. Mm-hmm. One of the pieces of collateral was the Star Wars 1313. Took place on, it was about the dark underbelly of Coruscant and like that kind of thing. Could totally see as a TV show, and maybe that's what you meant by Game of Thrones kind of world. Like I was thinking
go get away from. I think 1313 could have been cool, or Star Wars Underworld 2. Those things look, they could be visually cool, but also right now in the age that we have of The Expanse and a lot of other sci-fi drama out there coming out there that kind of sort of wants to inhabit that sort of space, it might look, it may be lost. But if you said, no, let's go. Let's dial it way back in a different way. But either way, I think I would just make an argument that I would love to see this more of when the Force was like magic kind of thing.
I think a big part of the seeing that Rogue One is coming out, I think really scratches a big part of the itch of that 1313 had me excited for. And so, in fact, it makes me think that maybe it's a smart thing, just as it was a painful thing to lose the expanded universe. It ended up being the right thing because we had mystery going into the new series. It was a painful thing to lose 1313, but I think Rogue One will scratch that itch in much the same way. I still would love to see all of the non-force aspects of this world. I think really, really excite me a lot.
I think we're getting that. I think that's that is certainly something that we will have delivered upon. But if we are going to keep a theme of...
Wait, I'm just going to make a prediction. Let me interrupt for a second.
Oh, go.
I predict this year we'll hear a Star Wars TV show announcement.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm down with that. I agree.
And you're totally right. That thing is a success at press release, right? Yeah. Like, you know, either it's going to be a huge network, you know, commitment, or if it's Netflix or you know, an online property, like there's just...
Yeah, and a story that can be told over, you know, that befits television versus something else where... I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's my prediction.
We have a theme for this After Things. It is overweight, graying, controversial creators.
Why did you have to bring me into this?
Oh, stop it. George R. R. Martin wrote on his live journal, which is always my favorite thing to say. His emotion was depressed. He told his fans that despite the fact that he swore up and down that he was going to have The Winds of Winter, the new book, out before Game of Thrones debuted its new season, and that he, as he details, he went to his publisher. The publisher said, hey, listen, if you can have it to us before October, we can have it out by the beginning of 2016. He blew that deadline. They said, all right, guess what? Forget that. We were just trying to spook you. Turns out we talked to Henry at the plant. We're going to figure it out. It's going to be fine. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Sorry, your hand hit something and USBs went a flutter.
Oh, no, it's actually, you know what it is? We got this dishwasher that is like flickering the power.
That's amazing. Yeah. No, everything's fine. Keep going.
Okay.
They're like, all right, guess what? Talk to the guys at the plant. If you can just get it to us by New Year's Eve, we just need it by New Year's Eve. We can have it out before the new season comes in. He blew that deadline. It's not going to be out before the series, and he doesn't think it might not be out this year at all. He is returning to his, you know, wait and see kind of attitude. This is obviously a song as old as time. George R. R. Martin doesn't have a book out when we want him to.
You know what? Let me be the first on behalf of the internet, on behalf of people who love Game of Thrones, on behalf of people who want to live, maybe not in all of the universe that he created. Let me be the first to say, George, take it easy. Do what you got to do. Whenever it's ready, it's ready. And you know what? If it's never ready, what can you do? It's a tough life. Listen, I want you to do yourself. Take the night off. Schedule yourself a pub crawl. Check out some NFL games. Blog about them.
Another film festival in your movie theater you built.
Yeah, build another theater. Yeah, do whatever you like.
I agree. I'm totally at this point. Like even. As a fan of the books, I'm just like, what's the point of even like having an expectation?
You know, this comes down to this perception, and it's interesting when you listen to J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan talking about making another Star Wars film, and there is and part of the frustration for many people, like, I had a friend who wrote an entire screed on Facebook when they threw out the expanded universe and just like, I'm done. I'm over with this. This is it's a betrayal. Brian, your emotions times 100, okay?
Yeah.
This guy was just – it was – nothing upset him more. 9/11 wasn't as impactful to him as that was. and it was this weird pervasive point of view that we often have that – these things are somehow real and that artists are channeling this, that there is a complete Star Wars story, not just the one that Lucas says, oh, I have this, but no, there is this thing. There is this beginning, middle, and end out there somewhere, and it's the job of whoever's in charge of that to tell us what this is and not just make it up as they go along. And that's what, you know, kind of with Abrams, you kind of were like, yeah, no, it's just like it's – what could episode 8? They could all die at the beginning. Doesn't matter. It's whatever they want to do. And with George R. R. Martin in this sort of this very real world, the more real these worlds feel to us, the harder it is for us. I'm like, why does it take so long to the books? Just tell us what happened. He's like, well, because he's actually making it up, guys. He's not like, you know, getting, you know, in the libraries of Westeros writing down this account.
I mean, at the end of the day, we're all, you know, just warriors gathered around a campfire and somebody's standing up to tell their story. And the only power we have is whether or not we clap at the end of it, you know?
But we think that we get into – many of us get invested in the idea that the story is somehow real. The story is somehow – and not to say that people really think this place is real, but they think
there's somehow some kind of inherent rightness and wrongness
exactly,
to doing it. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's like, no, it's all made up stories. The only thing you get to do is, you know, in the old days it was whether you would clap at the campfire. Nowadays it's whether you vote with your dollars and, you know, that's it.
Do you think that he is – you know, like, you know, let's play sports talk radio. Does this hurt his legacy? Will he be remembered as somebody who more often, you know, is he damaging his creative output by how slow he is putting out?
No, we're going to forget about delays. We don't remember delays. We remember the final product 10 years afterwards. Right. My guess is he's doing better by his legacy by making the difficult choice of breaking a promise today so that 3 months from now he can keep his deeper promise to have a good book moving forward.
I mean, you can certainly say his publishers are a little annoyed that some of these books are going to come out after the show is done and HBO and Time Warner Corporation are done pouring a gigantic amount of press and awareness so people, you know, will also buy the books. Like,
yeah.
Financially, it's something that they are surely very, very, very frustrated by, right?
Oh, absolutely. I would imagine they're losing.
As soon as the show's done, it's just going to go back to being – it's like what Lord of the Rings is now, right? It's like Lord of the Rings, super hot when the movies are out, mm-hmm. right? Like this is really, really hot because the show's out. And then eventually it'll be more popular than it was before, but it'll just kind of be a rad fantasy series that fantasy readers read and like, you know?
Yeah.
And the show will live on, but it won't be like this social coup of like, oh man, the Lannisters, well, they always pay their debts, don't they? Like, I'm really excited about all this.
What say you, Andrew?
Yeah, I agree. I think that they'll be continuously popular, but you certainly see how with the Harry Potter series, those books still sell extremely well. But when J.K. Rowling launched Pottermore as the online destination for Harry Potter fans, is that the idea that this is going to be a place where all the fans go, you can have this environment, it's going to be this Harry Potter all 24/7. And it was an amazing idea that came 5 years too late.
Yeah.
And that was the only place you could get the ebook versions of them, and that was going to be the exclusive place to do that. Quickly, we saw that started to shift and change, and now you can get – they have amazing digital versions on, you know, the iBooks, the Audible versions. The Audible books are now on Audible and all that because it just was – it was too late, too late. And Harry Potter is still huge and big. It's a very big franchise, and the Harry Potter attractions at Universal Studios in Orlando, colossal, the one they're building here, it's going to be – there's going to be no longer a slow season at the park here because of that. And so it will always be big, but the Harry Potter mania – of, you know, unless she does another book, which I, you know, I'm they're got to be doing a novelization of Fantastic Beasts, and she wrote the screenplay, so we'll see what happens to that. And so I think we might get a bit of that.
Yeah, you know, it would make a lot of
and
sense.
Cursed Child, I'm sorry, and the Cursed Child, the Broadway, or excuse me, the London play,
which apparently is like sold out through infinity.
Yeah,
like that's. If they bring that, I mean, you got to figure they'll bring it stateside, right? Like it's gigantic property.
And I just, my comment on that too is they unveiled the cast of it later on, and it, you know, a great, great experienced cast to do that. And they chose a black actress to play Hermione, and J.K. Rowling pointed out, says, "Hey, I never said, you know, she looked white or whatever, which is cool, but it makes." Malfoy really a jerk for some of his comments that he said.
Yeah, definitely hit the nail on the head with the KKK analogies for the Death Eaters, huh?
Yeah, wow. Blood and all this stuff. Like, wow, this has got even more evil.
That's amazing.
It's cool. And it's cool that, too, it's like, it's neat that I love the fact that she decided to go back and tell stories in that we're getting a prequel and then we're getting a play, that we're getting this sort of thing that she's invested and interested in it, and that she feels comfortable enough, like, you know what, like, I'm going to play with my literary version of this, and I'm going to give you a literary thing, and I'm going to go with the, you know, go against your expectations on that and make that universe bigger and more inclusive, et cetera, which is pretty awesome.
Well, I think we've seen, you know, a couple ways that people are, you know, they have guided their massive franchises. And maybe part of it is that, like, you're always going to have a complicated relationship when fandom gets that hardcore, right? Like, there's just always, I mean, these are, again, you know, they're creators, they're imperfect people like we all are that have, you know, flaws and stuff, and oftentimes that gets magnified the hotter the spotlight gets. But no matter what, you're going to have, you know, people that, you know, if it gets to this kind of blockbuster level, you're always going to have some kind of weird relationship with people who love your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're like Vince Gilligan, and who's like apparently the nicest person in the world, and, you know, everyone just loves no matter what.
Well, that's the same with J.J. Abrams. Is that? By all accounts, all of our friends who know him, everybody we know who's met him, he's a really nice guy. There's a reason why so many people were rooting for him to succeed, was because he's become a very successful person, yet, by all accounts, just chill. Do you see Larry Fong's photo of J.J. Abrams on Instagram?
Oh, on his Instagram?
This is great. So Larry, who we know, Larry's a magician. He's a cinematographer. He's currently the cinematographer on Batman versus Superman, and he's known Snyder, and it's funny, the first thing that comes up is his thing. Here's a photo of J.J. Abrams in his band.
Yeah! Oh.
That's something that Larry took. So apparently, back in the day...
That's amazing.
J.J. So Abrams, great. You know, the alternate universe where they got that MTV airplay, and he never went on to co-write like Toy Story and Armageddon.
That's great. All right. Picks. Well, I guess I don't know. I love Hateful Eight. Go watch Hateful Eight. It's really good.
Yeah. Watch Rebels. That's my pick. Rebels is good.
I've been catching up on Rebels too, so I'm gonna double down on Rebels.
Also, I watched Making a Murderer. It's a thing that'll make you feel some ways.
What was your take?
If there's some attraction to watching a slow motion train wreck, and just realizing, it awoke a lot of feelings that I got from the Wire, where it's like, oh yeah, this is, you know, this engine of the state is just run by a bunch of individual people looking out for number one, and they care about their reputation and their, you know, pension and all that stuff. And, you know, yeah, you know, drop a little bit of evidence over here. You know, it's like, what do these poor people matter? You know, I don't know.
I mean, come on, man. Now, man, could you just drop a little evidence over here now, man? Come on now. Drop a little evidence is all I'm asking.
I mean, let me get a little bit of the blood and just go glug, glug, glug over there with us. He's fine. He'd be all right. You don't belong in the outside world anyway.
Making a murderer. You know, man, I'm just trying to do just a little evidence.
Little soft-headed learning disability child. I got him to say the right word, didn't I? You probably want a murderer. Gonna be a murderer? Let's put him in the way.
I've already seen the series. If that was the lawyer, if that was like the lawyer for whoever is this guy, is
pretty much. I'm just a little evidence. All you know. There's a little miscarriage of justice.
I'm very curious to see it. I always have very conflicted feelings on documentaries like this.
I'll tell you what. I had very conflicted feelings, and continue, about the whole Serial phenomenon. Serial really upsets me in that it's just poking fingers around, stirring stuff up, and then shrugging, saying like, "Man, I don't know, complicated." Bye. Off it goes. I respect Making a Murderer much, much more because it is an advocacy. It has a position. It has a take, and it's clearly telling a lopsided story. To you have a hero, you have a villain, or at least some kind of complication. I respect it because I think it's much more honest than Serial in its biasness.
in that it is announcing its bias, correct, and saying, we believe that this man is innocent, and here is our case to show you that.
Correct.
That's the only thing, though, is that I sometimes get a little weird when that's the entertainment, when it's like, because... there have been a lot of very famous documentaries. There's been a lot of very famous articles written exonerating people in situations. And I have not seen this. I have no idea how it relates. But upon further review, you know, getting back to peer reviewing, we were talking about during Weird Things, a lot of these cases, you know, when you get into advocacy, you shape your narrative to show what is, you know, most favorable. And in some cases, you know, when you leave stuff out, it's like, well, no, yeah, maybe this guy or these people or this thing, you know, really did happen, or they really did do it. Or like, there's really good reason to believe that this happened. And when you get people so fired up about it and you criticize everybody who is in motion to put, you know, to involved in the case and drag their name through the mud, it's hard. You know, I get a little frustrated by that. I just always, it's not that I think that it shouldn't be there. It's not that I think that it's bad. It just, it always kind of gives me kind of a little bit of a queasy stomach to watch.
Well, I'm going to bet that sooner or later you'll give it a watch. I'd love to hear your opinion coming out of the other side.
Oh, definitely. I mean, everybody's talking about it too much for me to watch it. And also, like, I'm on this thing with Ashley. I just got to keep her watching TV, because it's like, now that I'm home all the time, it's like, listen, this is the only time I'm going to be able to do it. Like, I just got to get her into the, like, hey, everybody's talking about it. We got to watch it together.
What's curious, doing? I share Justin's frustration. There's been, and often sometimes too, when things, documentaries are very powerful and potent, and they're the very easiest way to mislead. And there's one that's been very popular lately that flat out contradicts. It's not, many things they said are not true. They assail certain, I don't even want to name it. There's certain people have got a fear that, you know, may have ruined some lives, but because the topic is so hot button and you, oh, we need to be talking about this. Like, yeah, but this isn't, yeah, but that's not important. It's like, no, when we start saying things aren't, it's the same as in cases where people do drop a little evidence. Like, we know he's guilty. It doesn't matter. And it's like, you can't, both of you don't get to do that. You know, both sides, you know, that it's a lie. It's a lie. It's a lie. There is no such thing as this lie that helps this greater truth, because if you're capable of lying to yourself on a small level and lying to other people to promote your truth, maybe you don't have truth. And I can think of like a couple movies like that. Ugh. Like, oh, do you ever see blankety blank about, so, oh, yeah, the guy that got free and then started beating up women because he actually was that bad of a guy? And like, oh, yeah, never mind. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, that's, you know.
Truth to power. It's been after things.
Yeah.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.